Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is an Empowerment Hour. Finding out how to supercharge your workout with a special juice. You won't believe how much pesticide you're eating every day. Blueberry powder shows a big benefit for lowering blood pressure. How hemp seed oil could offer hope to epilepsy sufferers, and much more on health and nutrition. From the environment, new research outlines the global threat of smoldering peat fires. Do you know what peat is? Well, we'll report from Tara Daly on how this can be a major, major problem. The hotter it gets, the more this peat is going to start catching on fire. Something momentous is happening in a good way. Hundreds of Stanford professors call for full fossil fuel divestment, meaning getting out. And the research is in. Regulations alone won't save us from climate disaster. We'll also be doing my guest in the second part of the program, coming to us from Europe, will be Gail Truesberg, what will the impact of low price oil have upon the U.S. economy? Now, Gail is an internationally recognized expert and an analyst on the economics of energy and peak oil and oil shortages and the impact of the energy industry on national economies. So we're going to talk with her about this. She is a graduate from University of Illinois and is a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society and a member of the American Academy of Actuaries. We're also going to have some commentaries today. One commentary, I promised the people in Harlem, the Haitians, where I demonstrated and spoke in front of Bill Clinton's office recently, and they're concerned that the American media has forgotten about Haiti. So today, Haiti, 5 years after the earthquake, which was yesterday, completely fraudulent reconstruction under the military occupation. Julie Levesqua from Global Research. I'll share insights about what's going on in Haiti, where all the money went. Billions upon billions upon billions of dollars. It did not go to the Haitian people. It did not go to improving the quality of their life. Where to go? You'll be surprised, but we'll detail it. And by the way, there were no media, even though all the media was invited to come up to the demonstration, which was a large demonstration. It was all Haitian. I was surprised. I thought at least some of the media would be there. And by the way, they even invited BAI and some other stations that they had hoped would come, but no one showed. But we were there. I did a lecture, and I promised them I would do this, so today I'll do that. And also from Robert Perry from Consortium News, the CIA's hidden hand in so-called democracy groups? Well, this is interesting. We want to know about this. And also today, I'll give you a rundown of some of the things we didn't get to yesterday, including the average college freshman reading at what grade level. I'll give you that. And also how Harvard professors are really outraged after learning that they actually have to pay more money for Obamacare. So we have a lot to share in a lot of areas. Now we begin. Getting ready for a championship race. One of the things I do is make sure that I take the nutrients that can help with energy, muscle, strength, stamina. But there's one juice, when combined with a water, makes all the difference in the world for any form of exercise. It's beet juice. It's easy to make beet juice. You can juice beets. It's that simple. Or you can buy it bottled, and that's okay too. You just get more enzymes and more antioxidants when it hasn't come in a bottle. And one beet, about the size of a baseball, will give you about 6 ounces of juice, and that's fine. That's all you need. Then give yourself another 6 ounces to 12 ounces of coconut water. Now, the coconut water is rich in potassium and electrolytes. The beet juice is important for all exercise, and a lot of athletes are using it now, including even competitors in the Tour de France, because it allows you to exercise up to 16% longer, as according to University of Exeter research. And an article was published in the Journal of Applied Physiology showing how people really benefit. You can walk further, you can cycle further, you can play whatever you're doing, basketball, tennis, longer, you have more energy. Now why? What's going on when that beet juice goes into your body? It's relatively simple. The beet juice widens your blood vessels, reducing blood pressure and allowing more blood flow. And at the same time, it reduces the amount of oxygen needed for muscles during activity. And you put all that together, you're going to have a greater exercise. Also, the higher levels of nitrate in the beetroot juice is responsible for the effects. Nitrate in beet juice is converted by bacteria on the tongue into the chemical nitrite, which eventually enters the bloodstream and lowers your blood pressure. So consuming nitrate-rich vegetables like beets and spinach and lettuce and other green vegetables, kale, that's a good source, that contributes to a healthy cardiovascular system. So that's one way that we can have a better workout. Also, the average person may not fully appreciate how damaging to their body are the pesticides. So we're not talking now about GMOs. That's separate. Just the full spectrum of all the other pesticides that go into our food. And we can get over 120 different chemicals per day into our diet. We didn't know were there. And the USDA allows all this. Yeah, and we get the 2,4-D. We still have residues of DDT. Of course, we get glyphosate and the family of products, including Roundup and neonicotinoids. 93% of Americans tested by the CDC had metabolites of a neurotoxic insecticide in their urine. Now, that chemical has been banned from home use because of its risk to children. And it is a part of a family of pesticides, what are called the organophosphates, that are linked to brain chemical imbalances and behavioral problems. And 99% of Americans tested positive for DDT chemicals, even though DDT hasn't been used in the United States since 1972. Women who were exposed to DDT as girls had 500% more likely development of breast cancer. I remember this because I was helping with Rachel Carson's efforts to ban DDT, and when I was the editor of Caveat Emptor, Consumer Beer publication, it was really an outstanding publication informing the public of what's wrong with our products. And I did most of mine on nutrition, pesticides, environmental products. Here was the government saying there's nothing wrong with pesticides, and they would bring in all these scientists saying, there's nothing wrong with DDT. Yeah, they were all wrong, all of them, and we're still having it in our blood today, and it's bad. One more reason to be very selective and try to get the foods that are organic, locally grown, and then, of course, when you take chlorella or spirulina, two single-cell algaes, and cabbage juice, with vitamin C, and you take that all into a juice or a smoothie, you're able to chelate out a lot of these pesticides. So it's good to do a one-day-a-week cleanse, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 juices in that one day, where you're having a lot of chlorophyll and cabbage and vitamin C. A good study done at Florida State University, published in the Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, shows that daily consumption of blueberries can help cut blood pressure and improve arterial health. Just 8 weeks of consuming 22 grams of the blueberry powder resulted in a reduction in systolic and diastolic blood pressure. Now, 22 grams is not even an ounce, so we're not talking about a lot, very small amount. That's equivalent to a teaspoon, that's all. So, blueberries, really good. Quote, to our knowledge, this is the first study to evaluate the effects of blueberries on arterial function, as was done in this study, as well as in this study population. These findings suggest that blueberries may prevent the progression of full-blown hypertension. So, we also know that, and this was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Now, why do I always, with every single citation, give where it's published, who did it? Because all throughout the world, we have scientists, we have public health officials, we have people who have physicians, nurses, and they like to know that the information shared comes from quality independent research. In fact, there's a whole group, a large group of professionals living in Sweden, and I met one of them when he came to my office, and I just happened to have been there, and he said, I just thought you'd like to know that there's a large group of us, architects, engineers, lawyers, doctors, and we listen to your shows on the archives. And he said, we really appreciate the fact that you always cite your references to show that it's just not opinion, that there's a solid base for it. So that's why I do that. And finally, there's good news for people suffering from epilepsy. And I would also suggest seizures with this. And this has to do with hemp seed oil. Now, it's been established that the brain has metabolic requirements that must be set aside by what we eat, and especially infants, or what the mother eats if they're breastfeeding. In particular, dietary fats are fundamentally important for thinking, learning, and memory abilities, and also helping protect your brain from damage. Now, the brain can build itself from saturated and monounsaturated fats, but it has a preference for omega-3 and omega-6 fats. Research on humans and animals suggests that optimal brain health is achieved when linoleic acid, lino, L-I-N-O, leic, L-E-I-C, acid, or what's called LA, and alpha linoleic acid are consumed in a ratio of 3 to 5 to 1 and 4 to 1, a ratio that can only be found in hemp. And the brain also has a requirement for cannabinoids, which regulate most of the major functions of the body, including alertness, emotions, inflammation, and cancer defenses. The brain can make a small number of its own cannabinoids, but when it's supplemented with hemp oil, which you can buy in any health food store, it facilitates the process. So what actually happens when you take a little hemp oil? No different than if you would olive oil and coconut oil. It's been shown that glucose receptor dysfunction in the brain is related to membrane instability from dietary essential fatty acids. So restoring adequate membrane essential fatty acids increases glucose uptake and utilization of brain cells. So quite simply, you get better glucose transport, more energy to the brain. You're energized. You also need membrane stability. That's crucial. And researchers from Israel tested the idea that optimizing the essential fatty acids could help prevent seizures in laboratory animals. And it was found to be correct. It worked. And so seizures were reduced by 90%. So that's important. And then there's cellular oxygenation. One of the functions of the omega-3, there's your flaxseed oil, walnut oil, almond oil, and omega-3 fatty acids from fish, and the omega-6 fatty acids, is to act as oxygen magnets and transporters. It's known that hemoglobin carries oxygen around the body. However, before oxygen can bind with the hemoglobin and red blood cells, it first has to be attracted to and released into the cell. This is exactly what the omega-3 and 6 does. So research in cystic fibrosis has shown that as cell membranes levels of linoleic acid, that's your omega-6, decrease, and levels of the oleic acid increase, the amount of oxygen entering the cell decreases. That's a bad thing. So they found that linoleic acid in hemp seed oil undergoes what is called reversible oxygenation, and that's a good thing. And then quite simply, you get more cellular energy. Remember, I've said it many times, human cells run on electrical energy. The more this electrical energy we have, the more alive we feel, the healthier we are, the more energy we have, the better all the processes, detoxification, nutrient assimilation, metabolism, hormone balance. So this energy ultimately comes from the sunlight, and we get it through eating green plants, and they get it through photosynthesis, and then we store it electrically in leaves and fruits. So every time you eat blueberries, apples, a lemon, orange, watermelon, lettuces, greens, you're absorbing energy, and your body then is able to take this and use it. And these are electron-rich molecules. In fact, it was back in the 1950s when German physicists discovered that the vibration frequency of the electrons matches the vibration frequencies of sunlight energy, and this makes the linoleic acids perfect receivers and carriers of sunlight energy. And they pick up the energy through the skin as the blood circulates the oil near the surface of the body and can release it directly into cells. So if we consume enough good fats, not animal fats, those are bad, that's arachidonic acid, you might as well stick a fork in your eye by eating arachidonic acids the way we do. They're just deadly. But when you eat good fats, avocados, good fats, walnuts, good fats, almonds, good fats, macadamia nuts, good fats, cashews, good fats, and their butters, pumpkin seed butter, sunflower seed butter, chia seeds, all good fats, then that really helps us, and it helps ourselves. So those are some of the reasons why we should make sure we have the right fats in our body. I'm Gary Noll. Nice to have you with us today. Now to our environmental segment. New research outlines global threat from smoldering peat, that's P-E-A-T, the fires. Now, from Terra Daily, they're talking about the natural disaster plays out like almost a movie script. Here's how it works. Ash falling from the sky, thick smoke shutting down airports and businesses across the globe, and uncontrollable fires burning for days and weeks. But this is not from a script. It's a vivid description of a future climate change scenario in which the Earth's peat-rich regions become more susceptible to drying and burning. New research published this week in the journal Nature Geoscience, co-authored by Adam Watts, a fire ecologist at Nevada's Desert Research Institute, outlines the threat of drying peatlands. These are known as mires across the globe, and their increased vulnerability to fire and carbon loss. We've heard about the great mires of Ireland and Scotland and England. We have them here in the United States. I used to own some land upstate in Goshen that was called black dirt, and it could catch on fire from a thunderstorm and burn for weeks, very difficult to put out. Rich soil, yes, great for growing everything, grew in it, but a problem, because when you don't have enough humidity, it dries, and boy, is it vulnerable. So already the largest fires on Earth in terms of their carbon footprint, that's how bad it is, these smoldering fires burn through thick layers of peat, build up over thousands of years, which blanket the ground in ecosystems ranging from the tropics to the Arctic. Quote, when people picture a forest fire, they probably think of flames licking up into treetops, an animal is trying to escape. And that's true. But according to a professor of Integrated Biology, University of Ontario, quote, but peat fires tend to be creeping ground fires. They can burn for weeks, even under relatively wet conditions. They lack the drama of flames, but they produce a lot of smoke, and that smoke contains large amounts of carbon and makes peat fires dangerous to humans' health. It can worsen air quality and even trigger asthma and other respiratory problems. And just remember, peat lands, which make up around 3% of the entire Earth's land surface, they store 25% of the world's soil carbon and are deposits of plant material and organic matter mixed with soil that is too wet to support high levels of decomposition, and they're on 7 different continents. So it's a big issue. We should be paying attention to it, address it. Good news from Stanford University. Hundreds of Stanford University professors published an open letter on Sunday demanding that the university divest, and that means sell, the entirety of its holdings from all fossil fuel companies. From Lauren McCauley, quote, if a university seeks to educate extraordinary youth so they may achieve the brightest possible future, what does it mean for that university simultaneously to invest in the destruction of that future? That's what the letter said. And it was sent to John Hennessy, president of the university and the school board of trustees. So I wished all of our major pensions and universities would divest from fossil fuels. And if we did that, then we could put our energy and money capital into renewables, which we need to do. But according to Winona Hotter of EcoWatch, it may not be enough. Now, I mentioned on this show that I don't attend any more of these climate summits because they're functionally worthless. It allows people to feel good, to network with and chat with scientists and activists and indigenous people from around the world. But as far as governments actually signing mandates that they must reduce carbon emissions radically and must fund renewables, they don't do it. It's all voluntary. So it's worthless. It's all a dog and pony show. Quote, we are convinced that any serious attempt to address climate change means that a large portion of the natural gas, oil, and coal currently locked underground must remain unexploited. Unfortunately, rather than aggressively deploying renewable energy sources, the Obama administration has opted to allow polluters to continue burning these dirty, polluting fossil fuels. Case in point, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is due to soon release rules to regulate methane leaks from natural gas production and transportation. But two new reports released this week underscore the importance of keeping fossil fuels where they belong, underground. This week, Nature magazine published a peer-reviewed paper estimating the percentage of fossil fuels that must remain unburned, meaning in the ground. Leave it alone. Don't touch it. It's been there for millions of years. Let it stay there. This came on the heels of our own analysis of how much natural gas, specifically, should not be exploited. How about all of it? So, unless you have government officials, meaning the President of the United States, willing to state clearly that we will not offer any government money nor any tax incentives to continue to explore or mine or extract or process coal, oil, natural gas, then they will continue to do so, and the industries will continue to use it, and pollution will continue to occur. And then we have tipped. Nothing in the world will bring us back at that point. So it's for we the people to realize that all these feel-good moments on radio and television and photo ops about how hard we're trying and we stayed up for days on end working, it means nothing. Nothing. if it's not mandated, and it's not. From our public health segment, from Dr. Joseph Marcolo, who I just spoke with, heavy cell phone use can quadruple your risk of deadly brain cancer. This is short, but it's important. Quote, no one wants to hear that something as indispensable as your cell phone might cause grave harm to your health, but that's exactly what mounting evidence tells us we're faced with. Wireless phones and other gadgets have the potential to cause all sorts of health problems, from headaches to brain tumors. The link between brain cancer and cell phone use has been a particularly persistent one, and mounting research has only made this association stronger. And then goes on to talk about the International Agency for Research on Cancer, an arm of the World Health Organization, declared, quote, cell phones a class B carcinogen, meaning possible cancer-causing agent based upon the available research. This places cell phones in the same category as diesel engine exhaust, pesticides, and heavy metals. The expert panel ruled that there was a, quote, evidence that regular cell phone use increased the risk of two types of tumors, brain tumors, gliomas, and acoustic neuromas. When you consider the fact that your body is bioelectric, it's easier to understand how and why biological damage from wireless phones might occur. So, we now have over 43 studies, good studies, showing cell phone use and cancers. That's not good. Now, let me just give you a preview of a few programs coming up before we take a break. First and foremost, tonight, 7 p.m., the Progressive Commentary Hour, we have a heavy lineup. Chris Hedges, Joe Bakken, and psychologist Joshim Hagopian. We're going to talk about the whole idea of abuse of power and influence everywhere in our world. Tomorrow at noon, Dr. David Ray Griffin on whether or not our civilization as we know it can survive the CO2 crisis. Next day, Representative Alan Grayson on how Congress has been completely bought. His colleagues are just pimps. Last day of the week, Professor Janice Vilhauer from Emory University on the struggles people have in confronting the future and what to do about it. So we have a lot to share in trying to get the people who make a difference. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Day after day I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know that's a game that I hate to lose. And I'm feeling the strain. Ain't it a shame? Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. Wasting time. I don't understand the things I do. The world outside looks so unkind. And I'm counting on you to carry me through. Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Speaking up on behalf of those in Haiti who seem to have no friends or supporters in the mainstream media nor any interest. Yesterday was the fifth anniversary of the major devastating earthquake in Haiti. I demonstrated on behalf of the Haitian activists and the people recently in Harlem in front of Bill Clinton's office. I was surprised at virtually no mention anywhere in the media of that, and yet it was a large outpouring of individuals. They had legitimate concerns, and yet no one wanted to hear their concerns. So where are we at today? What is the takeaway message? I won't go into all of the problems. I will post an article by Julia Levskwa from Global Research, Haiti 5 years after the earthquake, fraudulent reconstruction under military occupation, on our website today. I've already posted, I think, about 100 articles today. And by the way, on my Facebook as well as ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, on both sites, we post hundreds of articles per day from progressive stories around the world and documentaries, videos, calls to action. And we thank the nearly 300 million visits in the last 12 months. So here's where we're at. When anti-government protests occur in a country which is not led by U.S. ally, there's an extensive coverage. But Haiti's current leaders are considered suitable. Why? Because they were really selected, not by the Haitian people. Remember, in the real world of politics, people are always selected before they are elected. So America chooses Haitian leaders, not the Haitian people. And that's where we're at. So then we hear about international aid. What is the international aid? It does not help the people of Haiti at all. It's merely America's disastrous neoliberal policies which hinder genuine development and prevent the South's economic and political sovereignty. Where does the money go? Unfortunately, it goes into the very pockets of those who pretend to care. Haiti is probably the best example of how this works. Let me just give you a few examples. As a good neoliberal, never letting a serious crisis go to waste, Bill Clinton saw the 2010 earthquake as a great opportunity. Here's what Daddy Cherry says, quote, "A treaty in 1915 of the U.S. occupation forced Haiti to accept a post of U.S. High Commissioner to run the country alongside its hand-picked Haitian president. Control of the country's finances, public works, and public health services were transferred to southern U.S. Democrats who had supported Woodrow Wilson's campaign in much the same way that these are transferred today to USAID and non-GMO or the non-government organizations, the GMOs. The idea then was the same as now. All of Haiti's economy should serve the U.S., and nearly all U.S. dollars paid as wages in Haiti should return to the U.S. Clinton saw in the earthquake of 2010 and his opportunity to become the new U.S. High Commissioner of Haiti. Within 4 months of the earthquake, Bill Clinton formed the Interim Commission for the Reconstruction of Haiti, a strictly pay-to-play group of officials, rich business people from different groups that he had been affiliated with when he was president in other countries. They agreed to contribute armed personnel from their countries or money. In return, they all got a piece of the action in Haiti. After some arm twisting and bribery, the Haitian parliament was forced to declare a state of emergency for 18 months, during which Clinton and his group could do as they pleased with regard to reconstruction without any risk of liability. Well, all this time went by, and the Haitian Senate observed that nothing had been accomplished. The state of emergency was not renewed, and the Haitian government stated that there was massive fraud involved. Well, Bill Clinton's nefarious influence on the country is not new. A study of the economic liberalization strategies imposed by the U.S. on Haiti in the 1980s and 90s showed that, quote, President Clinton and other recent White House tenets condemned Haiti to a future of endemic poverty through self-serving U.S. rice export policies, end quote. The U.S. Agency for International Development, among other agencies, encouraged Haiti to start exporting manufactured and processed agricultural products in tandem with emphasizing the need to import grain staples on the international market. The U.S. exports worked to disable Haiti's rural economy, even though USAID officials recognized that such a move could increase poverty and contribute to a decline in average Haitian income and health standards. By 2003, approximately 80% of all the rice consumed in Haiti was imported from the United States. That's Bill Clinton. Haiti's earthquake disaster was an opportunity for business. Several industries, mining, garment, tourism, only to name a few, profited from the disaster. Donations have favored businesses in the donor countries more than Haitians themselves, and several projects have seen cost overruns and others ended up being useless due to the critical lack of infrastructure. It's well known and fully documented that independent media circles that international aid is nothing but business masquerading as charity. Approximately 80% of the aid money dedicated to developing countries ends up in the bank account of businesses and non-governmental organizations from the donor countries. Far from helping, this dynamic only creates a relationship of dependency, hampering, even preventing the recipient countries from developing the very structures which could liberate it from the colonial relationship. And while most people working for Western humanitarian organizations are well-intentioned, Western humanitarian policies toward countries like Haiti are deliberately designed to maintain the financial superiority of the North over the South. This has been demonstrated by the disastrous effects of the International Monetary Fund's infamous structural adjustment programs focused on massive privatization, free trade, which has destroyed local economies, agriculture, and food sovereignty in countries which now rely upon food aid. And that's what's happening in Haiti. And so then there is at the, when I went up to do the lecture, I took with me a list of the charities that have received money. One was $118,961,374. And that was just one industry. All told, you're looking at $13 billion. So what did they get in Haiti for $13 billion? A small country, $13 billion. Think that a lot would happen. No, you find out the largest single amount of money that went to Haiti actually didn't go to Haiti. It went through the Ministry of Health, and then it came right back to the U.S. military. $117,111,216 was allocated by the U.S. Department of State to the so-called United Nations Stabilization Mission, meaning armed men on the ground. Now, remember when I said at the time that you'll run out of food, you'll run out of water in Haiti, but immediately you will have warehouses full of food and full of water sent from around the world, but these will all be brought black marketed, and this will all be done in clear sight of all the armed officials, but they will do nothing because of how corrupt the entire system is. That's exactly what happened. So then they built hotels, and millions of dollars of aid to Haiti went to the hotels, but no Haitian stays in these hotels. And new commerce zones. Quote, April 2013, DynCorp received $48.6 million contract from the U.S. State Department Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement for a one-year period with a three-year option for the insertion of its trainees into the U.N.'s police forces in Haiti. So they're going to look for drugs in Haiti? Well, that's really a good use of $48 million. They're not doing anything with the slums. They're simply writing reports saying that the people aren't there in the slums anymore. Yeah, they are. They're a whole group, new group of new slums. Maybe Clinton couldn't find Kennan, Onaville, or Jerusalem, but they're all in Haiti, and they're all massive slums. So they moved them from one place to another and then said, we no longer have these people here. Gee whiz, we must have done a good job. No, you merely transferred them to another place. It's unfortunate. There are now 300,000 Haitians still living in camps, and there's nothing being done to help them. So once again, as has happened so often, the people of Haiti are suffering because of the complete corruption of the entire aid system. And that will not change in the foreseeable future. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
Trying hard to recreate what had yet to be created. her apology. Anybody else would surely know who's watching her go. But what if we believe? Do you see? The wise man has the power.
Thank you all for listening. Let's now go to our guest. Gail Verberg is an internationally recognized expert and analyst on the economics of energy, peak oil, and oil shortages and the impact of the energy industry on national economies. She's a graduate from the University of Illinois, and as I mentioned earlier, she has a website, ourfiniteworld.com. Nice to have you with us today, Gail.
Nice being here.
Gail, the last time we saw a steep drop in oil prices was just prior to the financial crisis in 2008. However, at that time, oil prices rebounded rather quickly. This time, we are to look at this a little differently because the Saudis and OPEC countries are working in a way that we are not clear. So will we be experiencing extremely low oil prices for a longer period of time? Or will they rebound? And before we get into the hard impacts this will have on the U.S. economy, such as energy company bankruptcies, large job losses, a crisis in the commodity market, and by the way, the commodity global commodity derivative trade is now $22 trillion. Junk bond defaults and perhaps a major stock market crash. Can you first speak on the major reasons for the sharp decline in oil prices? Because as of yesterday, it was $45 a barrel. The Saudis stated a couple days ago that we will never see $100 a barrel again. This does not seem realistic, knowing how they've played us so many times in the past. So the U.S. energy companies are being particularly hit negatively, and Bloomberg reported that rig counts are falling rapidly. And last week alone, 61 rigs were shut down, hundreds more likely. And each rig accounts for almost 100 jobs. So please provide us with your analysis for the reasons behind the falling oil prices and if this decline is completely manipulated by OPEC for reasons that we have not been told. The floor is yours.
Hi. Thank you. With respect to OPEC's role in these oil price drop, I think its role is actually fairly minor. I think that what we've seen is a long-term increase in the cost of oil extraction. I'll say that since about the year 2000. And at the same time, wages have relatively stagnated. So people's ability to afford the price of oil has been relatively dropping. At the same time, governments have been trying to get the more credit, more debt out there to sort of make up for the lack of wages. And so there's been this program called quantitative easing, and there's been, as part of that, an attempt to keep interest rates very low. And there's also been the big ramp up in China of its infrastructure. Well, what happened in the second half of 2014 was that both the U.S. Shut back on its program of quantitative easing at the same time that China cut back on its program of expanding debt. So what happened was that there was a big cutback in demand. I think this also goes with essentially recession kind of thing coming on in China, or relative recession, at least for China, but also for countries, Europe, Japan, you know, many parts of the world were doing relatively less well, especially now with the dollar rising higher. So there were a lot of different factors going in there. If you look at OPEC's oil production, well, especially if you look at Saudi Arabia's oil production, you see that it's basically flat. It hasn't done anything. You know, meanwhile, the U.S. ramped up its oil production at high prices, but the world could not take all of the additional oil that went on. There were also some fluctuations, say, with Libya going up a little bit, and and maybe Iraq going up a little bit. But whatever happens, you get all of these effects, and you say, oh, Saudi Arabia, you're supposed to fix all the problems? Saudi Arabia was sitting there with relatively less exports than they'd had a couple of years ago. So, it was like, asking them to reduce something that wasn't even particularly high for them. So I can understand their position that, how do we cut back now when it's all these other folks that have created these problems?
Give us a clearer picture of how collapsing oil prices will be affecting the economy. There are about 20,000 companies, large and small, that are part of what is being called America's hydrocarbon revolution. They employ upwards, I've heard a figure as high as 200,000 people. How are all these people being affected now? What's the likely outcome for them?
Well, I think that there's going to be quite a bit of job loss amongst the people who are working in the oil industry. I think then there's also the industries that are servicing those people who work in the oil industry. In other words, the grocery stores that get built because of all these new people that move to the area, and the firms that build new homes and sell cars to these people. And so you get, second and third order impacts of all of these people finding that their wages are being cut back. Of course, they have loans on their houses, and some of those people aren't going to be able to repay their loans if they can't find another job in the area. So you get that kind of an impact. But you also get an impact on those companies that have laid off all of these workers. Most of them have quite a bit of debt, and there's going to be a bunch of debt that can't be repaid. Some of these companies have also they've purchased derivatives of various sorts, which would essentially guarantee that they will be able to sell their oil, say, for $80 a barrel, even if the market price is $45 a barrel. And at some point, the piper needs to get paid on that. And what we'll find is that some of these derivatives aren't really working out right. And the way things are now being set up, instead of the federal government coming in and bailing out all of the problems of the banks, the current plan is to haircut the depositors' funds as opposed to the government coming in and stepping in. So there's a potential for that to come back and affect both businesses who would be paying wages, except that they get their bank accounts haircut, and I suppose even individuals could find their bank accounts haircut.
Which means that they would do a Cyprus bail-in, meaning they could take our money in our bank accounts and use it to pay the banks or the people who bet, and especially against derivatives. I think this is one of the most single, toxic, and dangerous precedents. It also shows you how corrupt, morally and ethically, our politicians are, knowing full well when they passed this that eviscerated anything that was even beneficial in the Dodd-Frank Amendment, but allows the banks to walk away, and we're paying their debt, yet we never benefit from their profit, but we do have to cover their debt. This, to me, is absurd.
Well, and I think it's more than just in the Dodd-Frank Amendment. I think that the way this is going to flow through, there may be defaults apart from the commodity market. It may be that the defaults turn out to be in interest rates switching rapidly, or in the different currencies, their relativities changing rapidly. And so we could get derivatives of many different kinds, and it might not have anything to do with the latest set of changes. I mean, we could have multiple problems going on simultaneously, besides having, just the normal run-of-the-mill defaults that we would be getting on loans, especially with respect to the shale producers, but also with respect to China and with respect to other emerging markets. So I think the banks are going to be in really tough shape.
Well,
one thing.
I believe they deserve it because they've been taking these risks and there have been no real reforms since it. Gail, one quick insight, if you would share it with us. We just went through years of quantitative easing. In effect, the Federal Reserve was printing money we were told as high as $84 billion, then it came down to $59 billion. But in point of fact, it was found by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts and others that they were also doing this through other countries, banks in other countries, even higher than the country's own gross domestic product, including Holland. So we could conservatively say around $90 billion a month. And this was merely putting more dollars into the supply, giving it to these preferred customers, the banks, Goldman Sachs, and these companies. Do you foresee that because of what's happening, they may reignite another round of quantitative easing? And what impact will that have on the average person's cost of living and lifestyle?
Well, I don't know whether it will reignite another round of quantitative easing. I know that taking it off has been a big mess just because the economy had become so dependent on it, especially with the other countries around the world doing it as well. So if it does go on, you know, then what happens to the average customer is that it helps the stock market go straight up, regardless of how poor the earnings are. It helps the companies buy back their shares cheaply, and so that it can look like they are making money when they really aren't. So the prices go up of stocks, the prices of houses tend to go up, but the wages tend to stagnate as badly as ever or worse. So it tends to increase the disparities between the wealthy and the not-so-wealthy even more than previously.
You've identified a list of bad effects that may be manifesting on the horizon, including increased debt defaults in the population. You just mentioned banks, rising interest rates, which would just devastate small businesses because we're getting zero interest on our savings, and rising unemployment. You also mentioned that we're not getting increased living wages, a decreased oil supply, derivative defaults, a drop in the market value of bonds and others. Speak on the ones that you feel are the most likely to be witnessed during the upcoming months or in this year, and what kind of impacts will that have on other major financial and banking institutions? Because I believe there is going to be a contamination effect. What happens in one area will affect other areas.
Well, it's kind of hard to know where to start on all of these things. It's sort of like a game of dominoes. You know, it depends on where the first domino falls and then what it pushes along and how it goes. You know, just the fact that you're having these defaults on these loans, or not the defaults, but the fact that the companies are doing poorly with low oil prices means that there are already higher interest rates on the these loans that are made to the poor, the ones with poor credit ratings. But there's a temptation of the government to impose higher interest rates on everyone for a variety of reasons. They've been talking about going back to higher interest rates for quite some time. If this should happen, any kind of higher interest rates create a problem just because then the costs of everyone go up. I mean, the cost of buying a house or a car or anything like that goes up. So what happens is that there's less buying power out in the economy. So I think that if to the extent that this happens, the whole economy suffers. There's, you know, various other kinds of things that can happen in terms of emerging market debt being a problem, as I was mentioning before. I think one of the big issues that comes up is that the amount of oil supply could actually start going down. It very much likely is going to start going down with the prices low. And once it goes down, it's likely to be very difficult to get it to come back up again. And part of that is that with the rising interest rates, especially for the shale drillers, the cost is going to be higher to come back than it was before they left. So they're actually going to need a higher price coming back in than they needed before they left.
They also are now sitting on $400 billion in loans, the energy companies. $400 billion. You and I could never allow ourselves to get in that kind of debt, and yet because they had high returns initially, the banks and the major institutions gave them the money. Now, with the falling price of oil, you're going to see all forms of panic happening because someone's going to default on that $400 billion. That's a reality, and it's going to play out in the near future. We're out of time. Thank you very much, Gail, for coming on. We appreciate it and sharing your insights on this.
Well, it's good being with you. Thank
you. Gail's website is ourfiniteworld.com, and her name is Gail Verberg, and it's spelled T-V-E-R-B-E-R-G. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now let's say hello to Utrece Lead. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. Today, how badges get shielded. Reports confirm systemic problems in the New York Police Department.
Okay. Utrece Lead right now.